of more than 30 cities in 11 states across the country. When I read these articles, I thought about the commitment I'd made after meeting with Howard Zinn. I'd promised to be more diligent, to watch more closely what was going on in my own community, my country, and the world. I began to see a change in the public's attitudes. September 11, 2001, had terrified the nation into giving up its freedoms. But continuing reports of torture at military bases and CIA rendition sites, attacks on whistleblowers, police brutality, and eavesdropping on personal phone calls was turning the tide of opinion. Increasingly, the media and blogs were pointing out that such activities were inconsistent with laws intended to protect our privacy. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, news reports in December 2005 first revealed that the National Security Agency, NSA, has been intercepting Americans' phone calls and internet communications. Those news reports, combined with a USA Today story in May 2006 and the statements of several members of Congress, revealed that the NSA is also receiving wholesale copies of Americans' telephone and other communications records. All of these surveillance activities are in violation of the privacy safeguards established by Congress and the U.S. Constitution. The draconian jackal measures, revealed in the thousands of pages released by WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden, tell a shocking, disturbing, and sad story. Many Americans have come to understand that the democracy their government was supposed to protect has been betrayed by that government, that the very foundation of Lincoln's government of the people, by the people, and for the people were buried in the ashes of Ground Zero. I was shocked to learn that the NSA monitors about 200 million text messages each day and has surreptitiously planted spy software in some 100,000 computers, allowing it access to the information in those computers. Perhaps it's just ego, but I wonder if my computer is one of those. As jaded as I've become about the immoral and criminal, even if technically legal, activities of our jackal agencies, I was outraged by revelations that the organization that had recruited me, the NSA, had eavesdropped on the phone conversations of 35 world leaders, including listening to confidential discussions held at the highest levels of the governments of Argentina, Brazil, France, Germany, the UK, and many of our other allies. According to The Guardian, the NSA encourages senior officials in the customer departments, such as the White House, State, and the Pentagon, to share their Rolodexes so the agency can add the phone numbers of leading foreign politicians to their surveillance systems. This struck me as unacceptable, but it also was incredibly stupid diplomacy. Among the repercussions, German Chancellor Angela Merkel objected strongly, and Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff postponed a state visit to Washington. Another tool at the disposal of the modern jackal is that of character assassination. Every president, every politician and government official is aware that a scandal can bring him or her down. President Clinton served as a warning to all leaders, present and future. Whether Linda Tripp was hired to set up Monica Lewinsky, as many suspect, or not, Clinton was impeached, politically assassinated, because of a sex scandal. In my day, everyone knew that President Kennedy was having multiple affairs, and nobody thought it was the public's business. It took a bullet to assassinate him. Today, people in powerful positions around the world know that modern eavesdropping technology can be used to destroy them, or to plant incriminating evidence that will destroy them. In many parts of the world, today's jackals are supported by a growing class of mercenary forces, hired guns who do not answer to the same rules and standards as military personnel. By 2012, there were almost 110,000 contracted mercenary forces in Afghanistan alone, compared with 68,000 U.S. military personnel. To place this in perspective, in Vietnam, there were 70,000 mercenaries and 359,000 military forces. Although information is not available about the number of active mercenaries worldwide who are paid with U.S. taxpayer money, we know it is in the millions. In a 2014 survey that ranked the 30 most powerful private security companies, the number one spot went to G4S, a firm that employs more than 620,000 people and earned more than $12 billion in 2012. In addition to supplying soldiers, G4S sells state-of-the-art spying and monitoring equipment to governments and corporations. Interestingly, Blackwater, renamed Academy, the mercenary firm best known to the general public due to the company's alleged involvement in the killing of Iraqi civilians, came in at number 30. The use of mercenaries allows Washington to claim that the military is winding down, that U.S. death tolls are decreasing, and that the government is not responsible for torture and other war crimes. Mercenaries avoid the need for an unpopular draft like the one during the Vietnam War that incited the anti-war movement. They support the jackals' illegal activities without reporting to the Pentagon, the President, or Congress. They are accountable to no one. The ability and willingness of the corporatocracy to spy on our every movement and to take action, including imprisonment without habeas corpus or assassination, when we do anything perceived as a threat to its greed-driven power, is virtually unlimited and totally undemocratic. Its lobbyists own our elected officials. Its special operations teams conduct illegal assassinations. Its low-flying pilots and robot jackals monitor our phone and internet connections. All of this is part of the corporatocracy's determination to do whatever it deems it will take to maintain control. Recently, however, the corporatocracy's actions have escalated to near panic levels. To a large degree, this is driven by its fear of a new superpower, China. Chapter 45, Lessons for China. In 2015, a top Ecuadorian official told me, "We'd rather accept loans from Beijing than Washington. After all, China has never overthrown or killed our leaders, unlike the U.S. When I pointed out that China had a history of invasions in Asia, he replied, "Yes, they've seen those places as part of their ancient kingdom, but they haven't done it in Latin America or Africa or the Middle East. The U.S. has." We were discussing the debt audit commission that had reviewed the legitimacy of the loans taken on by Ecuador's CIA-supported dictators during my EHM days. The commission's findings had convinced President Correa to default on loans worth more than $3 billion. In retaliation for the president's initial refusal to pay $30.6 million that was due on $519 million of outstanding global bonds in 2012, Standard & Poor's rating services and Fitch Ratings slashed Ecuador's credit rating. Correa turned to Beijing. China offered Ecuador a $1 billion loan, which soon was increased to $2 billion. As his government repaid that loan, Correa reestablished Ecuador's global credit standing, but he also made his country beholden to China and its version of EHMs. By April 2015, Ecuador's debts to China had risen to almost $5.4 billion, representing 28% of its external debt. In the summer of 2015, I returned to Ecuador. Fundación Pachamama had been legally dissolved, but there had been no attempt to inhibit the work of the U.S.-based Pachamama Alliance. I joined Bill and Lynn Twist and Daniel Cooperman on our annual trip to lead a group of supporters to Ashuar territory. As we made that spectacular trip from Quito to the airstrip in Shell, from which planes would take us deep into the jungle, I once again stared at the massive concrete wall of the Agoyan hydroelectric dam. For me, a symbol of the legal crimes I'd committed, and one that evoked memories of the assassinated Jaime Roldós and the very recent attempted coup that had changed Correa. I thought about how the abuses of the World Bank, the IMF, Wall Street, the credit rating services, and the rest of the U.S./European banking community have driven Ecuador and its oil resources into the arms of China. When I traveled past this dam in 2003, it was assumed that most of the country's oil would go to the United States. By 2015, that had totally changed. China was buying almost 55% of Ecuador's oil. Exports to the United States, meanwhile, had decreased from about 75% of Ecuador's oil to none. I realized that, perhaps more than anything else, China's role, not just in Ecuador, but in the entire world, offers insights into the future. China's expansionism, like that of the United States and the other empires of history, revolves around lending money to countries, plundering their resources, and paralyzing their leaders with fear. China is playing off the fears of men like Correa and citizens of countries such as Ecuador and Honduras, and just about everywhere else. Whereas we in the United States are taught to fear China, Russia, and terrorists, a large part of the world fears us. They fear the Pentagon and the military presence that Washington has established in more than 100 countries. They fear the CIA, the NSA, and all the other U.S. spy agencies. They fear the drones, the missiles, and the bombs. They fear our dollarized, debt-based money system. In addition to the obvious physical fears are the more subtle ones. Economically developing countries fear their vulnerability to global corporations. Because of the trade agreements and conditionalities imposed on them through the debt agreements, their economies seem dependent on those corporations. They fear they can't survive without the corporations. They fear that the corporations will go somewhere else to locate their production facilities. But they also fear that if those facilities are built within their borders, the corporations will bury the country in pollution and force workers to accept unlivable wages. They fear that the corporations will eventually leave them for another country with even less stringent environmental and social regulations, dooming to extreme poverty or starvation the people who abandoned their subsistence farms to work in the now vacated factories. A system based on fear and debt may seem effective, yet history has shown that empires never last. The tragedy of America's rise and fall in the modern world represents a colossal failure on the part of corporate and government leaders. After the demise of the Soviet Union, the new corporate barons believed they had license to do whatever they deemed it would take to realize their goal of maximizing profits, including corrupting politicians and manipulating the legal system. Aid organizations, such as the World Bank, increased the interest rates on loans, made political demands, and imposed conditionalities on the debtor countries, influencing the way they governed themselves and related to the United States and the corporations. It did not take long for people in those nations to recognize that they were being exploited. However, they had nowhere to turn, no counterbalancing power. The Soviet Union was gone. The economically developing countries had no choice but to give in and feel abused and resentful. Then, almost overnight, China emerged as a new world power. Its meteoric rise as an economic giant and major player in international manufacturing and trade thrust it onto the world stage as that counterbalance. China appears to have learned from mistakes made by the United States, its allies, and the corporatocracy. Chinese loans usually are not accompanied by draconian demands, the conditionalities of World Bank and IMF deals, such as voting for specific UN policies, trading only in dollars, or allowing the establishment of military bases occupied by foreign troops. China makes promises that the factories it builds will continue to operate in the long term. It remains to be seen whether such promises will be kept, but the United States promotes free trade agreements that do exactly the opposite. However, despite China's apparent aptitude at doing it better than the United States and its allies, the simple fact remains that China is using debt, massive amounts of it, to further its own EHM system, to control countries and their resources. Although it is difficult to measure the total amount of debt money flowing from China, estimates are that it committed nearly $100 billion in loans to Ecuador and its Latin American neighbors from 2005 to 2013. Its current loans to the region are perhaps twice that amount, and certainly surpass the combined loans of the World Bank, USAID, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Export-Import Bank of the United States. China is the driving force behind the new BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, Bank, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, which includes more than 50 member countries. The assets and potential power of these banks dwarf those of the World Bank and all its associated financial institutions. In less than a decade, China has catapulted itself to the position of master of global debt. A New York Times article I read while in Ecuador reported events that sounded like the U.S. EHM activities of my day. except that the Chinese were taking on more projects and spending more money than we ever did. Where the Andean foothills dip into the Amazon jungle, nearly 1,000 Chinese engineers and workers have been pouring concrete for a dam and a 15-mile underground tunnel. The $2.2 billion project will feed river water to 8 giant Chinese turbines, designed to produce enough electricity to light more than a third of Ecuador. Near the port of Manta on the Pacific Ocean, Chinese banks are in talks to lend $7 billion for the construction of an oil refinery, which could make Ecuador a global player in gasoline, diesel, and other petroleum products. Across the country, in villages and towns, Chinese money is going to build roads, highways, bridges, hospitals, even a network of surveillance cameras stretching to the Galapagos Islands. State-owned Chinese banks have already put nearly $11 billion into the country, and the Ecuadorian government is asking for more. Ecuador, with just 16 million people, has little presence on the global stage. But China's rapidly expanding footprint here speaks volumes about the changing world order, as Beijing surges forward and Washington gradually loses ground. Our Pachamama Alliance group huddled in a hangar in Shell, waiting for the torrential jungle rain to stop so we could fly into Ashuar territory. When I brought up the subject of China, there seemed to be a consensus that China had performed a miracle and should be feared. The country had risen from the ashes of Mao's Cultural Revolution and, in the years since President Nixon's first visit in 1972, had enjoyed amazing, miraculous economic growth, like nothing ever before experienced by any country in history. However, this had come at a terrible environmental and social cost. The nation was smothering itself in pollution, and millions of Chinese were living under substandard social conditions. People expressed fear that China was rising to world prominence and that the Chinese model would cause even graver problems than the U.S. model had. I'd been to China a couple of times since writing Confessions of an Economic Hitman. My last visit had been as a speaker at an MBA conference in Shanghai. Many of the Chinese MBA students who attended were members of the Communist Party and had been singled out as the future leaders of their country. They emphasized that they were very concerned about the environmental and social problems affecting their country, and they were committed to fixing them. One student, Mandy Zhang, insisted that economic growth was proof that China could create an economic miracle. "Now," she said, "my generation must create a green miracle." One of the Pachamama Alliance people in the hangar asked, "What can we do? How do we stop China?" If we are truly honest with ourselves, we in the United States have to admit that it is not so much about stopping China as about changing our own mindsets. We need to admit that a great deal of China's pollution is our pollution. The same can be said of the social conditions. We purchase the goods made in those factories. We seek out stores with the lowest prices, but the vast majority of their products are made in the polluting factories of China. In a very real sense, China's economic miracle has been possible only because of the United States and the global corporations. Key individuals in China have joined the corporatocracy. China is the world's largest exporter of manufactured goods. From 2001 to 2010, its reported exports increased at an average annual rate of about 20%. In 2004, China sold less than $200 billion worth of products to the United States. By 2014, that figure had more than doubled to $467 billion. Instead of speculating about China, we must repent and reform. We need to take a long, hard look at what we in the United States and our corporations, now gone global, have done. China is trying to emulate a system that is a failure. If less than 5% of the world's population living in the United States is consuming more than 25% of the resources, how can 19% of the world's population, living in China, hope to replicate our lifestyle? It's certainly not possible to also add India, Brazil, and the rest of the world to that equation. We must change. We in the United States and across the globe must stop using them as scapegoats. Just as we must not fear them, we must not blame them or expect them to solve the problem. The global problem of predatory corporate capitalism, a death economy. We need to recognize that they are us. We ourselves, each and every one of us, must take responsibility. We must create a new model, one that the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Indians, our own president, our corporate and government leaders, and everyone else can follow. It isn't about changing the mechanics of economics. It is about changing the ideas, the dogmas that have driven economics for centuries. Debt and fear, insufficiency, divide and conquer. It is about moving from ideas about merely being sustainable to ones that include regenerating areas devastated by agriculture, mining, and other destructive activities. It is about revolution. The transition from a death economy to a life economy is truly about a change in consciousness. A consciousness revolution. Chapter 46. What You Can Do. John Lennon said, "All you need is love," Samantha Thomas told me. What better way to honor the Peace Prize than through a summit that reflects his ideas? Yoko Ono had awarded me the Lennon Ono Grant for Peace, and along with it, a major contribution to Dream Change. The organization had been relatively quiet for several years, but now Samantha, a brilliant, dynamic, and determined person in her 20s, had come on board as its executive director. She wanted to sponsor a 2015 conference that would encourage businesses to achieve higher, more compassionate standards. She and I convinced Dan Wyden, co-founder and chairman of the board of Wyden Kennedy, one of the most successful and highly respected advertising agencies in the world, to co-host it with me. From the beginning, Samantha had called it the Love Summit. At first, Dan and I objected. We were concerned that love might be inappropriate for a business conference. However, our attitudes soon changed. Like many of the attendees who were successful entrepreneurs and corporate executives, Dan and I came to understand that when we love ourselves, the earth, and one another, everything gets better. Several speakers pointed out that marketing is aimed at convincing consumers to love a company and its products. To change the world, all we need to do is inspire consumers to love companies and products that serve life, and to persuade business people that if they want their companies and products to be loved, they must commit to doing just that. As I listened to speaker after speaker expound upon the need for businesses to move into a new consciousness, I kept thinking about Tunduam, the Shuar shaman who had saved my life by changing my mindset. The world is as we dream it, and we've been living a dream that combines excessive materialism with a divide and conquer them versus us mentality. If I am to have more stuff, we've told ourselves, I must take it from them. It is time to change that mindset. It is time to act in ways that support a new dream. When Samantha said, at the close of the summit, "It turns out that love really is all you need," I realized that she was expressing the basis of a new dream. It is the dream that indigenous people and spiritual leaders, from Mother Teresa to the Dalai Lama, from the Buddha to Pope Francis, have always dreamed. It is a dream of love, for ourselves, for each other, for nature, and for the planet. It is a dream that tells us to replace the old dream of a death economy with a new dream of a life economy. This new dream is of an economy that cleans up polluted waters, soil, and air, empowers hungry and starving people to feed themselves, develops transportation, communications, manufacturing, and energy systems that do not deplete resources, applies recycling and solar technologies, creates market, banking, and exchange systems that are community-oriented and not based on debt currencies or war. In essence, it is a new dream founded on courage and love rather than fear and hatred. Since 2004, when the original of this book was published, I've spoken at conferences of business executives, at rock concerts, and at consumer summits. I've met with government leaders and lectured at universities in many countries. I've grown increasingly impressed with the messages I've heard. Entrepreneurs, lawyers, executives, farmers, and homemakers, people from all walks of life, are changing their dreams from the ones prevalent 10 years ago about wealth and power to the ones more common today, about the desire to raise families in an environmentally sustainable and regenerative, socially just, and personally fulfilling world. People everywhere understand the need for this revolution. We know that we must do whatever it takes to birth a life economy. We also know that each of us must do the things we love. You and I, we, are the ones to make this revolution happen. To do that, we must love who we are and what we do. This book demonstrates that global corporations run this failed geopolitical/economic system. To change the system, we must change the dream of corporations. Some argue that we need to rid the planet of corporations. However, the likelihood of this happening, at least in my lifetime, is extremely low. I think instead we need to take the shamanic approach to transform, shapeshift, the attitudes and goals of those who own and manage the corporations. Corporations are highly effective at channeling brilliant ideas into concrete action, but their dream of maximizing profits without regard for the environmental and social costs, their orientation toward pillaging resources and promoting debt and materialism, has been disastrous. It is time for a new dream that is based on serving the earth, the public, and future generations, not just of humans, but of all beings. We are empowered by the many ways we've changed corporations in the recent past, by boycotting ones that supported apartheid, polluted our rivers, refused to hire women or minorities, objected to same-sex marriages, rejected organic produce, opposed food labeling, and so much more. We are encouraged by the knowledge that many executives and business owners are as concerned as anyone else. Whether they are employees of Fortune 500 corporations or proprietors of mom-and-pop stores, they are not members of the corporatocracy and therefore are exploited along with the rest of us. Even the so-called 1%, which are actually the 0.1%, are threatened. If this space station crashes, we all crash. When I was first invited to speak at corporate conferences and MBA programs, I asked the organizers why they would want to hear from the author of a book such as mine. They answered that their people were smart enough to recognize that the current system verges on collapse. Until now, business people may not have thought in terms of a death economy versus a life economy, but they understand that to be successful, they will have to embrace new models. They are searching for innovative approaches and ways to implement them. CEOs who desire to change their corporate strategies tell me that they fear that if they lose short-term market share or profits, they will be replaced by someone who cares only about market share or profits. Feeling trapped in an archaic structure, they crave consumer movements that generate thousands of letters and emails saying things like, "I love your product, but will not buy it until you pay your workers a living wage." They can then take this information to their executive committee, key stockholders, the founder, or whoever has the ability to fire them. For me, hearing such admissions is encouraging, because it identifies us as the ones with the real power. It tells us that the marketplace is a democracy, if we choose to use it as such, that every time we buy something, we cast a vote. It also provides a way to enlist the people on the inside of corporations. This revolution needs people on the inside. They can play major roles in creating the new economy. We are in this together, all of us. We must do what it takes to cultivate the life economy. Now, it is time to admit that we are not fighting a war against terrorists, corporations, or any other them. We are engaged in a course of action to end the EHM system. We are all a part of a process that has failed us. We've bought into it, we've supported it, we've praised and glorified it. Now we must act to change it. Like the Andean brickmakers discussed in Chapter 1, we need to face our fears, take offense at the injustices we've suffered, and stop looking for others to set things right. We must be willing to do whatever it takes to ensure that our children have a future. When I was growing up in New Hampshire, I wished I'd been born in the 1700s so I could participate in the American Revolution. But the American Revolution was only a partial success. Although the British were defeated, many injustices continued for years, affecting women, minorities, the middle class, and the poor. Now those injustices affect us all. They threaten life as we know it on this planet. Today's revolution is much bigger than the American Revolution. It is bigger than the agricultural or industrial revolutions. It is nothing less than a consciousness revolution. The change in consciousness includes a transition from masculine, hierarchical mindsets and actions to ones that are more fluid, egalitarian, and feminine. It necessitates an acknowledgement that defending our home now means nurturing our home, and a recognition that our home is the entire planet. This book has described the four pillars of modern empire: fear, debt, insufficiency, the temptation to keep consuming more, and the divide and conquer mindset. The idea that anything and everything is justified, coups and assassinations, drone strikes, NSA eavesdropping, as long as it props up those four pillars, has shackled us to a feudal and corrupt system. It is a system that cannot be sustained. We must do whatever it takes to change the dream behind such justifications, to convert fear into the courage to create a better world, to replace debt with generosity, anxiety over insufficiency with certainty that a life economy provides sustainable abundance. We must transform masculine aggression with feminine nurturance. We must replace divide and conquer mentalities with compassion and a commitment to regenerating ravaged environments. We must unite as a crew that will navigate this space station toward a truly prosperous future. During my travels, one of the things I hear from people is that Confessions of an Economic Hitman connects the dots. In 2004, those dots led to the conclusion that people had been terribly misinformed about how the United States and its corporations deceive, abuse, and exploit economically developing countries. The post-2004 dots go much further. They lead us to the conclusion that we in the United States and in the rest of the so-called developed countries also have been hit. We have been abused and exploited by many of the tools that I and other EHMs used in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. Connecting the post-2004 dots leads to the additional conclusion that we must do whatever it takes to change. We must act. Such actions start with the recognition that we are presented with many choices throughout life. Fate, chance, accident, opportunity. We can see these things as good or bad. What is important is not so much that they happen as how we react to them. I once accepted a lot of money not to write a book. I chose to use the money to help people in countries I'd exploited. Out of that came my reconnection with Amazonian people, the formation of several nonprofits, and a new career as a writer and public speaker. When we look at things that happen to us as bearers of messages, we open doors of opportunity for action. The Earth is offering us a strong message. The ice caps and glaciers are melting. The oceans are rising. Species are going extinct. This planet, our home, is demanding that we see her as a living Earth. She is not just a mass of rock and soil spinning around an indifferent sun. She is a biological member of a living universe, and she is sending us a message. Repent, reform, love her. What will we do with that message, you and I? We have the opportunity to dream a new dream, to explore options for exciting alternative ways of living, for turning failure into success, for building systems that, like the living Earth, are organic, are locally based, and at the same time, interweave the fabrics of our global community. Your gifts include your personal passions and skills. Whether you are a carpenter, a dentist, a writer, a parent, a student, or whatever else, those gifts are yours. True success comes from following your unique passions, employing your skills, and joining the growing community that is determined to create a better world. You can start with your individual behavior, recycling, driving less, turning off lights, shopping and banking locally, and so forth. But do not fall into the trap of believing that those things alone are enough. See such actions as good, but also view them as portals into new ways of relating to the world and everything around you. On a flight a few years ago from Leh Ladakh to Jammu, India, The group I was leading ended up on the same plane as the Dalai Lama. When he learned that the author of a book that he liked, Shapeshifting, about indigenous shamans, was on board, he invited me to sit next to him. We had a lively discussion about shamanism, and as the plane landed, he offered a further invitation for my group to visit him at his house in Dharamshala. As we chatted with him that afternoon, he told us that it is good to pray for peace. But, he added, if that is all you do, it's a waste of time. It may even be a distraction. You need to take appropriate daily action. He smiled that Dalai Lama smile. You must act every day. The Dalai Lama's words are applicable to the actions necessary to create a life economy. Recycling, driving less, turning off lights, and other such commitments are good, but it is important not to let them distract us from dreaming bigger and taking appropriate daily action to make that bigger dream a reality. Likewise, despite all the teachers who tell us that thinking positively is all we need to do, it is not enough. More than 1 billion people live on the verge of starvation. For them, driving less is not an option. Thinking positively will not put food in their bellies. We need to do more. We need a revolution. Revolutions happen because people come together and act. Although key individuals inspire and lead others, revolutions succeed because of communal actions. The rugged individual as hero is an old story. It diverts from the need for collective actions that generate real change. The Dalai Lama knows this. The Sangha, community, is one of the three jewels or tenets of Buddhism. Every religion, every social and political movement honors the power of community. My Uncle Ernest, the bank president, understood the importance of supporting his local community in Waterbury, Vermont. The drive to build local communities has gained strength in recent years. Farmers markets, the emphasis on buying locally, the reemergence of community banks, and even the commitment by large grocery chains to purchase produce from neighborhood growers are all part of an important trend. At the same time, a whole new aspect of global community is evolving. On a trip to the Himalayas, several months before the first version of this book was published, I talked to a tribal elder who lived in a tent more than 14,000 feet above sea level. He lamented that his people would never have telephones. The lines can't reach this high, he told me through an interpreter. I heard something similar from an Ashuar leader deep in the Amazon rainforest. Now, as I write this new version, both of these men and their communities have satellite phones. For the first time in history, we are communicating instantaneously across the planet. And we all are reaching the conclusion that each of us, every living being, is threatened by the same crises of rising oceans, overwhelming pollution, melting ice caps, species extinctions, overpopulation, and the devastation of natural resources. We know that we must do whatever it takes to turn that around, to dream a life economy into reality. When audience members ask me what specifically they can do, I start with, you must follow your passions and use your talents in the most efficient, satisfying, and enjoyable way you can. Then I mention some of the appropriate daily actions we all can take. We can join nonprofit and other non-governmental organizations and consumer movements aimed at boycotting specific corporations. We can support reform movements aimed at such things as taxing corporations, regulating banks, getting money out of the electoral process, and stopping the causes of climate change. We can participate in demonstrations and marches, write blogs, books, or articles, make videos or movies. We can run for elected office or campaign for the place where we work to commit to public service. We can spread the good news about a life economy. We can buy magazines and watch TV programs that feature women and men who express the new dream. The choices are practically unlimited. We each can spread this new message in our own way. The carpenter can build houses with local, sustainably produced materials, incorporate solar panels and other energy-efficient technologies, and constantly brag about it. The dentist can talk about the life economy while filling a cavity. The mother can teach her child to buy local products and save in a community bank. Each of us can take his or her own path, as long as we all head for the same destination, an economy that works for everyone. American history offers a great lesson in this. Tom Paine did not try to lead armies. George Washington did not write pamphlets. Martha Washington did not write pamphlets or lead armies. Tom Paine had a passion for writing. George Washington had a passion for leading men. Martha Washington had a passion for organizing women to make clothes for soldiers. They took separate paths and headed for the same destination, getting out from under the yoke of British tyranny. You must take the path that is most effective for you, the one that offers you the greatest joy. During demonstrations to end the Vietnam War, we were invited to feel our bliss factor. Teach-ins, love-ins, music, dances, and festivals blossomed across the nation. The most successful ones were pro-peace rather than anti-war. People stuck flowers into the muzzles of soldiers' rifles. Folk singers wrote songs honoring the demonstrators and glorifying peace. The movement was successful because we participants came together in communities that enjoyed the process, and because we were passionate about a cause. I've watched recent social, environmental, and peace movements burn out because passions were not honored in ways that evoked joy. The dream is not just about the destination. It must include every step along the path. Obstacles, which will be encountered, can seem as great opportunities to learn and to gain strength. The lists presented in the following chapter offer ideas for specific actions you can take. These are only suggestions, and the lists are by no means comprehensive. At first, I was reluctant to provide these suggestions, because I thought they might seem to trivialize this dream-changing process. Then I realized that as long as they are understood to be part of a process, beginning points, inspirations, they serve a purpose. A friend, Tracy Apple, told me that she felt a deeper connection to the earth when she stopped using plastic bags. It led her to more actions, including becoming a key developer for the Pachamama Alliance's Awakening the Dreamer program, which, as of this writing, has been conducted in 82 countries. I understood, she said, that when I commit to an action, I'm contributing a part to something that is far greater than the sum of those parts. Giving up plastic bags was important by itself, but it was also a portal into a new level of consciousness. The lists in Chapter 47 are divided into six categories. 1. Things we all can do. 2. Things students can do. 3. Things retired people can do. 4. Things people between student age and retirement age can do. 5. Things corporations can do, and consumers can insist they do. And 6. Things entrepreneurs can do. These are suggestions intended to inspire you to do whatever it takes to follow your passions and create the world we all know is possible. As you read the lists, please keep in mind that perhaps the most important advice of all is to enjoy the process. Follow your bliss. Make it fun. Don't burn out. Whenever you come up against an obstacle, see it as an opportunity that excites your creative juices and enables you to experience the joy of finding solutions. Whenever someone criticizes you or tells you the life economy is impossible, or whenever you meet a roadblock such as police officers preventing you from marching, understand it as a manifestation of the old story. Like a good martial artist, gather strength from such actions. Use the energy to energize you. It is time for you and me, us, to do whatever it takes to bury the death economy and birth the life economy. Chapter 47. Things to Do. The following lists are meant to stimulate you to come up with your own plan of action and are by no means intended to be complete. Neither should they be considered exclusive to the populations identified in the titles. In other words, if you are a student, feel free to draw from the retired people's list and vice versa. Be sure to choose items that fit your passions, that raise your bliss factor, that bring joy into your life. Doing whatever it takes to birth the life economy must be fun. Of course, there will be times when you encounter obstacles and setbacks. See these as challenges that stir your creativity and offer opportunities to experience the joy of creating solutions. Understand that love really is all we need. When we love ourselves, our planet, and one another, when we do the things that increase our ability to love and encourage others to do the same, everything works. 11 things we all can do. 1. Keep telling a new story. One that is based on creating an environmentally sustainable, resource-regenerative, socially just world where one group of people does not make other groups of people desperate. This story is about cleaning up pollution and regarding our planet as a living being, helping starving people grow, store, and transport food more efficiently, living less materialistic and more spiritually fulfilling lives, developing new technologies for energy, transportation, communications, banking, and wholesale and retail trade, bringing diverse communities together with the understanding that we all live on a fragile space station that has no escape shuttles. In other words, tell the story of converting a death economy to a life economy. Spread this story every chance you get to as many people as you can. Talk, write, make videos, offer study groups. Do whatever it takes. 2. Shop and invest consciously. Replace recreational and mindless shopping tendencies with activities that truly nourish you and those you love. When you must shop, buy locally, as well as at consignment and thrift stores. Make things last. Buy goods and services from and invest in businesses that are committed to making a better world. No one is perfect, so seek out the ones that are doing the best in their field. Email them about the good things they are doing, encouraging them to get even better. Also, email the businesses that you avoid, telling them why you refuse to patronize them. Insist that any organizations and pensions or other funds that you are part of do the same. 3. Live consciously. Focus on doing things that enhance your relationship with other people, your community, and the world around you, including honoring nature in whatever form it takes in your locale. Break old patterns that revolve around materialism and buying stuff. Downsize your house, car, and wardrobe. Bicycle or take public transportation. Avoid activities that use fossil fuels. Give talks at local schools, libraries, and other forums. 4. Pick a cause that appeals to your deepest passions and support it on a regular basis. This could be changing a corporation, such as Monsanto, Chevron, or Walmart, or promoting a movement, radio station, blogger, nonprofit, or non-governmental organization. Give it your attention every day, in the form of time and energy, even if only for a few minutes, or money. Use social media to let all your friends know what you are doing. Craft emails and letters about your cause and distribute them frequently to your social media contacts. Ask them to distribute these to all of their social media contacts and so on. 5. Become part of the living local community. Use local banks that invest in local projects, local merchants, locally owned restaurants. As much as possible, buy food that is locally and organically grown. Use materials and goods that are local and or environmentally and socially responsible. Create community gardens and urban green spaces. Encourage everyone you know to do the same. Vote for Enlightened School and other local leaders. Join or form groups that bring people together to have fun doing such things. Bicycle, nature, book, change the world clubs. Be creative. Drink tap or filtered, not bottled, water. 6. Flood media outlets, corporate executives, and government officials with information about the need to move from a death economy to a life economy. Do this locally, nationally, or internationally, or all three. 7. Support reform movements that most appeal to you. These will be country and community-dependent activities to encourage geopolitical, economic, and social reforms. Demand such things as guaranteed living wages and or employment, health insurance, medical care, and retirement pensions. 8. Encourage the creation of local, national, and or international parks, wildlife preserves, and other such areas. If you live in an urban setting or a rundown area, organize people to turn vacant lots into parks and playgrounds. Spend quality time in these places and encourage everyone you know to do the same. 9. Fight for campaign finance reform and or climate change regulations in the United States and elsewhere. Join organizations such as Move to Amend, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, the Citizens Climate Lobby, the Pachamama Alliance, or others that appeal to you. 10. Avoid debt. Take positive actions to pay off credit card charges and other debt without incurring interest payments. Make a point of using cash whenever possible. 11. Make heroes and icons of people who are working to create a better world. Honor the founders and managers of institutions and movements discussed in numbers 1 through 9 above, the visible and behind-the-scenes people who create an environmentally sustainable, resource-regenerative, socially just world, who help starving people feed themselves, and who promote better business and living models, rather than the CEOs of irresponsible corporations, overpaid athletes, or celebrities. 9 things students can do. 1. Learn all you can about what's really going on in the world. Understand that the mindsets created by the stories we are told and that we tell each other and the distorted history of humanity that is taught to our children are extremely powerful. Look to the alternative media for the story behind the story. 2. Question authority. Know that there are many conspiracies intent on deceiving you. Question and stand up to them every chance you get. By doing so, you will change the mindsets and a new story will evolve. 3. Understand your passions. What do you most enjoy in life? Focus on activities that bring you joy and on developing a deeper appreciation of and knowledge about subjects that most appeal to you. Determine to live your life according to your passions. Recognize that the most important education you can get involves self-knowledge and a commitment to living your bliss. 4. Seek out others who are looking to change the story. Join or develop communities of people who are intent on helping each other rise to new levels of understanding and living in ways that are more connected to each other and to our living earth. 5. Speak out. Help people who do not fit the definition of number 4 previously to understand the deceptions we're fed. Teach your contemporaries and let your elders know that your generation is not going to be hoodwinked. 6. Take a stand against debt. Do not accept burdensome student loans or credit card and other debt. Join organizations that help students avoid debts and/or get out from under existing debts. 7. Work for your passion. Go to work only for organizations and businesses that are consistent with your passions and philosophies. If you can't find any such jobs, create your own. Take the route of the self-starter, the entrepreneur, and refuse to be caught in work patterns that deplete your energy and creativity. 8. Join organizations. Participate in nonprofit and other non-governmental organizations, societies, or movements that support the things you feel most passionate about, such as Generation Waking Up, Move to Amend, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, the Citizens Climate Lobby, the Pachamama Alliance, Dream Change, and others. Get involved, take action, become part of those communities. Offer them your creativity and talents or money to support positive change. 9. Make videos or films aimed at ending the death economy and building a life economy. These could focus on whatever most appeals to you, human, animal, or plant rights, consumer or social movements, economics, politics, or history, science fiction stories about the future, or a limitless number of other subjects. 6 things retired people can do. 1. You can't be fired, so rattle the cage. Get involved in activities that might have frightened you before. Don't be afraid to express yourself and even be outrageous. 2. Take action. Follow your heart and get involved in causes that appeal to you. Avoid the temptation to believe that you are past your prime or unable to offer something meaningful to the world or to become distracted by self-absorbed activities. Enjoy leisure activities such as golf, cards, tennis, sailing, watching TV, but also understand that the greater pleasure comes from offering what you have learned in life to bigger causes and creating a better world for future generations. 3. Mentor younger people. You have a great deal to offer, whether you are a carpenter, a teacher, a health worker, a gardener, a business executive, or whatever. Recognize that your experiences are precious and can help those who follow. Elders in indigenous communities traditionally have been honored for their wisdom. Honor yourself as an elder and teach young people to make every job, every activity, about nourishing life and a life economy. 4. Demand responsible investments. Insist that your pension funds, mutual funds, and other investments be dedicated to serving the public interest and creating an environmentally sustainable, resource-regenerative, socially just world. Let the funds and corporations where you own stock know that you want them to be successful and that this means participating in the creation of a life economy. 5. Participate in or create campaigns that affect government, politics, and corporate policies. Run for office or support candidates who do, join consumer movements, or take whatever path draws you to be a full participant in the democratic process. Realize that this is not just part of being a true advocate of democracy. It also is deeply rewarding and fun. 6. Share your story. Tell others, especially younger people, about your life and the world you grew up in, how it worked, where it failed, and what needs to be done now to create societies that are resilient and that honor all life. Do this in small family or community gatherings, as well as before larger bodies such as service clubs, and through writing, film, art, music, or whatever vehicles work best for you. Tap your unique gifts and talents. 9 things people between student age and retirement age can do. 1. Be aware of what is going on in your community and around the world. Dig beneath the surface. Don't allow yourself to be duped by the media, politicians, corporations, or governments. 2. Develop communication skills to help everyone around you gain greater awareness of what is going on. Realize that being dogmatic or judgmental usually does not work. Did you know that is more effective than don't you know that? Although, remember to ask questions that spark people's curiosity and creativity. This can be more effective than overwhelming people with your own ideas and information. Use whatever channels are easiest for you. Talking, writing, emailing, texting, posting on Facebook and Twitter. The list goes on. 3. Demand economic and tax reforms, such as accounting practices that internalize costs, strict oversight of Wall Street and big banks, and tax laws that force the wealthy and corporations to pay their fair share, and that encourage socially and environmentally beneficial technologies. Vote only for candidates who support these. Buy only from businesses that comply with and promote such reforms. And let the candidates and businesses know. Write letters to editors and blogs, post on Facebook and Twitter, and so on. 4. Form or join consumer movements, nonprofits, and non-governmental organizations that promote businesses that serve a public interest, the 99.99% rather than the 0.01%. Call and or send emails to your local and national representatives, urging them to support these movements and to vote for such reforms. 5. Help form and or support community-based businesses, such as consumer co-ops, community corporations, certified B corporations, local public banks, and worker-owned businesses. 6. Join demonstrations, protests, and worker-slash-student-slash-civil movements that fight for better social and environmental conditions. Actively participate or give them financial and social media support. 7. Develop an awareness of your own biases around race, religion, financial status, immigration, gender, and other issues, and work toward overcoming those biases. 8. Teach younger people to be activists with soul. Help them to understand that democracy is based on being informed and educated about what is going on in the world, and taking inspired action. 9. If you work for a corporation or own stock, speak out. Make it known that you want the company where you work or where you own stock to be successful, and that the successful businesses of the future will be those that nourish a healthy, resilient natural environment and that contribute to the joy, harmony, and equality of their employees and of the communities they serve. See also the next section, 11 Things Corporations Can Do. 11 Things Corporations Can Do and That Consumers Can Insist They Do. 1. Include in your goals and mission statement a commitment to serving the public, the natural environment, social harmony, and justice. Of course, this must be tailored to the corporation's specific goods and services. It should be the driving force behind all activities and an integrated and powerful aspect of all marketing programs. Let it be known that this corporation is looking out for the future as well as the present.